Welcome to In Loving Recollection. This is your pal, Brent. When my dad was 6 or 7 years old, his family would begin building the home where he would spend the rest of his childhood. Prior to this, they lived in a 2-bedroom shotgun house located in the Hillside community, a mill village like that of the many others that were established throughout LaGrange, Georgia, and the Upland region. His parents, my nanny and pawpaw, along with many of his other relatives, were all mill workers, just one family among thousands employed by the textile industry that had blossomed in the area beginning in the late 1800s. Though my pawpaw had grown up in LaGrange, his family was not native to the area. They were glassmakers originally from Ohio that had been lured down to Tallapoosa, Alabama, due to the supposed presence of magical sand. After moving around to various towns for work, they would eventually settle in LaGrange, being compelled to do so by the prospect of steady employment that could be obtained by working at one of the mills. Many of the other mill village families had also arrived in LaGrange under similar circumstances, as the textile industry was one of the few employers in the region that could guarantee a consistent paycheck during an era in which that sort of thing could be somewhat hard to come by. And because these families had come from all over, as is often the case with migration, these new residents of Troop County would bring with them their various customs and traditions that would then converge with the already established culture, giving these mill villages a very distinct character. Around this same time, just an hour or so north of LaGrange, a similar type of community had also emerged. Located in East Atlanta, the mill village that would come to be known as Cabbage Town would be home to a large number of families with Appalachian roots who would travel down from the mountains of North Georgia to work at the Fulton and Bag Cotton Mill. Many years later, after the mill had closed and the area experienced a decline, a large number of creative types, attracted to its location and cheap rent, began moving into the neighborhood. And, as is often the case with migration, these new residents of Cabbage Town would bring with them their various customs and traditions that would then converge with the already established culture. Given this neighborhood and the scene it would eventually birth, a very distinct character. I guess this is all to say that only a place like this, one with such a rich and unique history, could produce a band like the Rockettines, and an album like Golden Time. Now, I first heard the Rockettines in high school while listening to the Georgia Music Show on the greatest college radio station of all time, Album 88. I have no memory of what song was actually played, only that I do remember liking it, but, and I am a little ashamed to admit this, my interest in the band that day didn't really go beyond that, which is unfortunate for me, as there was a lot there that would have definitely appealed to my taste. They were Southerners, they were on Merge Records, Superchunk's label, and they loved reverb. It would be, for whatever reason, many years before I would actively seek out this band's catalog. What finally did it for me was seeing Rockettines frontman Chris Lopez, with his solo project Tenement Halls, open for the Glands at the Earl in Atlanta in 2015. I was won over by the wild abandon of the whole performance, and thought I should probably investigate this act a bit further. Then I discovered that he was the guy from the Rockettines, the band I had been meaning to check out for over a decade. I didn't really know where I should begin, but after reading a review of their 1999 record Golden Time, in which the writer called it a triumph and structured chaos, I felt like this might be a good starting point. So I decided to dive in. I put on Golden Time by the Rockettines, and much like I should have done many years before, I listened. This is the story of that record.
My name is Chris Lopez, and I am the singer, guitar player, and other instruments for the Rocketeens, Atlanta, GA. I moved to Georgia when I was a teenager, you know, we were in high school, just coming to Atlanta to do things and, you know, go to shows and stuff, and then just eventually, as young people do, you know, go live in the city where all the action is. Yeah, I moved into this house in Cabbage Town, which was a very cheap place to live. Met a lot of people there, and yeah, it's just kind of turned into a little bit of a community.
The Rocketeens' Chris Lopez would spend the first part of his childhood in Dearborn, Michigan. And it is there at an early age that he would become interested in music.
Yeah, Dearborn is directly adjacent to Detroit. It's not really kind of the same thing, but I mean, I guess you could imagine it being like Decatur to Atlanta, maybe, but it is its own thing, because that is, like, you know, the home of Ford Motor Company and kind of like a cradle of the auto industry, as it were. But yeah, it's just like, it's back in the 1800s, you know, a village adjacent to Detroit. Michigan Avenue kind of goes from Detroit on out. So it's just kind of there's parts of it are just kind of just industrial. You know, Industrial Revolution, you know, everything adjacent to the auto industry, basically. Music's always been a big important part of my, like, life and my inner life. Ever since I was a little kid, just sitting, like, on the floor, like, you know, stereotypical picture of, you know, some kid in front of a stereo, you know, with the headphones on, you know, with my father kicking me to turn down, "You're going to ruin your ears," you know, listening to some, you know, whatever, like some dubbed cassette my dad made of like Magical Mystery Tour or something. It was just something that always interested me, you know, seek things out, you know, and then as you get older, find people. When you find people that are as, you know, obsessed with it as you are, you know, you kind of share things and people turn you on to things as time goes on, you know, you get older, and it's still like that to this day, for better or for worse.
Eventually, Lopez's interest in music would inspire his learning to play it.
When I was younger, my brother bought a drum set. Have absolutely no recollection of how he got a hold of it. Kind of a ramshackle drum set that we would set up in the basement, and he would, you know, play to records, and then I would, you know, when he wasn't around, kind of sneak into playing the drums at my peril, you know, could get, you know, caught using his drums. But kind of started there, and we had a piano in the house. My mom, she played the piano and tweakly dink on that thing, just trying to, you know, entertain oneself. I moved to Georgia when I was a teenager. Father got a new job. I moved to Marietta. You know, I lived in Marietta and went to high school in Marietta, and then got like a cheap acoustic guitar from my uncle or something, I seem to remember. And that would be like 12th grade, you know, and then I kind of got obsessed with trying to figure that out. Kind of turned out I was better at kind of like making up little ditties than I was copying other people's songs.
It is during his early 20s that Lopez would begin to play music with other people, as well as make frequent trips down to Atlanta for shows. Eventually, this would lead to him relocating to Cabbage Town, and in time, becoming involved with its musical community.
For a while in my early, like late teens, like early 20s, 21 or something, lived for a couple of years, like on the square in Marietta, in a just a raggedy house that was kind of like the hangout house for everybody, sort of our very small group of friends. Like at the time, the square in Marietta, it wasn't a desirable place for most people to live who could really make a big choice of where they wanted to live. So that's when we kind of started to like play music, figuring it out, like playing with other people. Like, you know, my friend Alan played the drums, and yeah, we could play at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was where this house was, it wouldn't bother anybody. There's like nobody around. They since tore it down and built a library there, but it was just kind of like in the middle of this kudzu field that was kind of this little gully that you couldn't build anything really in, except now it's like a, you know, a parking lot. So lived there for a while. Then while we were living there, we were always coming to drive into town to see shows and stuff. And I could say inevitably, you know, some opportunity comes up, and I moved to this house in Cabbage Town. It's kind of one of those things when you're young, you just kind of find people to hang out with, and met a lot of people there. And I got involved with the Opal Fox Quartet, which eventually became Smoke, which would be basically the first band I was ever in. Yeah, so that was kind of like based around kind of more like, you know, Little Five Points. Like Little Five Points Pub is where we would play like Sundays at brunch. From that, certainly met a lot of people. It's kind of like a blur to like kind of put the timeline together. Dottie's over on Memorial Drive was kind of a hub. It was pretty wide open where it wasn't like a professional thing. So it wasn't like a club. All the people that just kind of hung out there also would have bands. People would be in different bands and more than one band, or somebody would start a band and it would last a month and it'd be like the greatest band for like a month, and then it just kind of fizzle out and something else would happen. And yeah, it was just kind of a, you know, big part of just, you know, youthful social life as well. Because people always ask, you know, as you get older, like, well, how do you know so-and-so? And all I can say is like, I don't know, just like hanging around. You just, you know, got to know them because they were standing next to so-and-so when I was here, and they talked to them. And, you know, when you're young, all that social scene develops on its own. You don't really intellectualize it. It just happens. And you just, it just is.
After spending some time playing in bands within the local scene, Lopez would begin to experiment with songwriting.
Didn't really write songs in Opal Fox Quartet, might have contributed something, but I was always kind of just trying to make things up. I think at the same time I was in Opal Fox Quartet, I joined this band, Dirt, that was kind of like a punk rock band, kind of noisy. I guess you kind of say it's kind of grungy-ish or something, in the true sense of the word. And I was playing the bass because somebody left, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'll try that. And John, who sang and played the guitar, he left. And then that was kind of like, well, maybe I'll try and sing and play the guitar and make up some songs. I never really sang in a band. I'll try this. And yeah, then just kind of went from there. And then I really kind of like got into the process. And then that ended it. And that's when the Rocketeens situation came together, where it was kind of more focused on from my point of view and aesthetic than from like a band that was already kind of there. If that makes sense.
Cabbage Town's musical community would begin to experience a number of tragic losses, starting in 1992 with the deaths of Robert Hayes and Rob Clayton of the Jody Grind, and legendary Atlanta spoken word artist Tim Ruttinger, also known as Deacon Lunchbox. Lopez's close friend and Opal Fox Quartet and Dirt bandmate Alan Page would pass away in February of 1994. In the spring of that same year, Lopez would begin playing music with drummer Chris Vereen, guitarist Justin Hughes, and Jody Grind vocalist Kelly Hogan, eventually settling on the Vereen-suggested moniker of the Rockettines.
I'd already known Kelly a long time, and we had been in a relationship, but we weren't anymore. And she had been in a band, and that had ended. So I already knew her, and yeah, the beginnings of it are extremely blurry now that I'm thinking about it. And Kelly didn't know what she was doing musically, like literally, like, I'm going to play the guitar. I don't know how to play the guitar. And we would just kind of like, well, maybe you could do this or this on this one string and sing along. And then I don't know how Chris Vereen got involved. I mean, I would assume that through Kelly, you know, she was like, oh, I know a guy. And I probably knew Chris somewhat from DQE band he was in with Grace Braun and another one of those hanging around kind of things. So us three were playing, and then he said, oh, my friend Justin is coming back from college. He knows how to play the guitar. He could be in our band. And so that's how Justin got in our band. And then we were a band, and then we just went from there. That period of time was, we'd all kind of, experienced some loss. So, I guess there's, a little bit of, like, what do we do now kind of thing, perhaps. Or this would be something to do, but certainly not even thinking. It was just, it was something to do, and it was fun, and it was easy, and we enjoyed it. There's a strong sense of like discovery with it too, speaking for myself and maybe even Kelly, and kind of like learning and growing quickly with music and making something out of nothing.
Within a year of forming, the band would begin to work on their self-titled debut after having signed with Damon Records, an independent label based out of Decatur, Georgia, run by the Indigo Girls' Amy Ray. Working with producer David Barbie, a veteran of the Athens music scene, and at the time, a member of Bob Mould's post-Husker Du project, Sugar, the band would record the bulk of the album at Ballstown Recordings, a studio located in Midtown Atlanta that was then owned by Bobby Brown and would years later become the Outkast-affiliated Stankonia Studio. Damon Records would release the results in January of 1996.
Sometime in that first year or so, I think like Amy Ray was talking to Kelly. What are you doing? What you been up to? Oh, you're doing this? And then like later on, like she's like, oh, I dig that. I have a label. Would you be interested in, recording a record? I can give you a small amount of money, but I can put it out. And you're like, sure. And we just went from there. Most of it was recorded in Atlanta. And then there was some like extra in Athens. But I think even outside of Athens at a, I can't remember whose studio it was. But David came here to town.
The band would release one more full length with Damon Records, 1997's Cry, before moving on to the Chapel Hill, North Carolina-based indie stalwart, Merge Records, to release their third album, 1998's Baby, A Little Rain Must Fall. Prior to this switch to Merge, the band had already begun to experience a significant change with the departures of founding members Kelly Hogan and Chris Vereen.
We played some shows with Superchunk, and then I think we did it. Yeah, we did a single with them, and then we were like, you know, it'd be cool if we could do an album. And they're like, yeah, sure. So then we did that. But then, of course, things kind of changed right then. And yeah, that's when Brandon joined the band and Kelly left. And Chris left too. And so it was us three made that record. And I played drums on it for the most part. And then after that was done and we were getting ready to do shows, or we needed to find a drummer, that's how Ballard entered the picture.
With touring in support of Baby A Little Rain Must Fall complete, Lopez would begin to work on the material that would make up their next record.
It was something that I was just always doing. Like, something that was happening all the time. I mean, it's not like an organized thing, just part of day-to-day life, just to be fiddling around with something, and something would be, you know, more complete than others. And like a lot of things would get started and abandoned, or we try to, you know, practice and try to get things together. And then certainly when you're like, I guess we kind of could make a record, it would kind of take on a little more sense of urgency of like figuring out what we wanted to do. We'd put out a record and tour, and that would be about it. It never became that kind of concern. Everybody was still having to, yeah, be home because they had a job or whatever. You came home with less money than you left with routinely.
For Golden Time, the band would bring in musician Rob Gale to produce. A long-serving member of Atlanta's underground music scene, with stints in such notable acts as the Coolies and Ottoman Empire, Gale had previously worked with the band on their sophomore effort, Cry. And like they had done with Cry, sessions for Golden Time would take place at Gale's Atlanta studio, the Snackin' Shack.
I want to say it was on DeFores Mill Road, but it's like off of Howell Mill Road, Chattahoochee. I guess you would call it the West Side now. He was kind of in that warehouse district back in there in this house. Yeah, and it was just nicknamed the Snackin' Shack. Yeah, it's just a, you know, weird house with windows covered with painted plywood for soundproofing. Cool little space. When it came around time to do that next record, Golden Time, just worked out that we did it with Rob. You know, Rob, you know, the comfortable to work with. You know, there's no weird studio vibe, you know what I mean? Very involved in what was going on and having opinions and, you know, down with all of your weird references, because he is much deep into music and culture as we were. So it was a good working relationship. A lot of our MO, certainly with that, would be like Ballard and I would kind of get our act together, like the song arrangements down and what he was going to do. And then Justin and Brandon would kind of figure out what they were going to do through that, if that makes sense. But yeah, Ballard and I would make like a strong framework, or like the very least get the drum parts down, you know, him playing the way he's going to play the song, and then those guys could overdub it. There was a lot of stuff happening on the fly in the studio, which was also a big MO lots of making stuff up as you went along.
And in the end, they had made a record. Golden Time opens with Black Metal Stars, an exercise in both energy and atmosphere, as well as a prime example of the type of experience the listener is in for, featuring a glorious mess of reverberating guitars alongside a resilient rhythm section that's able to cut through the band's unique version of the Wall of Sound. Lopez pushes his manic vocals to their limits, creating a thrilling sense that the whole endeavor is on the brink of collapse. To quote the character Nathan Johnson from the classic film The Jerk, "This is the kind of music that tells me to go out there and be somebody. Or at the very least, start a band." If I could be everything she sees on the page, the glossy magazines. And if I could love the way she does, all the boys who travel the sandy beach, and I could be alone.
That song is like, the guitar is tuned a little different, like in like some sort of like G, sort of an open, but not an open G. Some like high string is tuned down, so that little riff is kind of like a chordal in a way, even though it's just like two notes at once. It's kind of where that song kind of came from, and it's just kind of like a almost some sort of like music hall kind of thing if you really squint your ears a little bit. Then it kind of just goes into that, I guess you'd call it a chorus, where it's like doom 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 doom. I don't know, there's a lot of weird, I don't even know how to describe that. All I can think of is like kind of music hall, like a music box or a calliope or some sort of thing going around and around and around. Speaking of Brandon's bass playing, he like changed the kind of the way we were as a band just by his musical personality in there. Because like, speaking of gear, he was like, not being like a bass player with a big Fender bass or whatever, with a big, you know, bass amp. And he was always kind of changing what he was doing, but like, he was playing like his bass through like guitar amps, like small guitar amps, you know, like a little Gibson RB, I don't know any of the name, GA, whatever, but like a small 60s guitar amp. And he'd have like two of them going together of two completely differing brands. And he'd have like a hollow body bass or some like off-brand bass with, you know, black wound gut strings on the bass. So it was like really thuddy. And yeah, he was amazing in his like experimentation with what playing the bass, you know, could be. certainly in that song, yeah, it sounds like Justin and I are like playing as something that's kind of going down, and then but Brandon is going up. Definitely talking about Florida and kind of Florida culture in a way. It's kind of, there's a little bit of like a in joke involved in that. We've come across in our travels some, you know, underground metal, black metal, however you want to describe it, culture that we found interesting. There's like this magazine, The Grimoire. I can't remember if it's called something like that, which was like a metal magazine, fanzine kind of thing, that had ads in the back that was like really descriptive of people starting bands that were like, no gutturals is for like the singing, or no screaming, gutturals only. So a little bit of that is, and then it's just like kind of a somebody wanting to be seen. You know, it's if I could be what you like or love, but I will never be that. It's just kind of, that's kind of the theme anyway. A lot of it's kind of hiding behind some things, trying to communicate something emotional, but trying to hide a little bit behind something. That's kind of what's going on there.
Following Black Metal Stars is the warped rockabilly of Little Caesar on a Bicycle. He's got mountain blood, 300 years old. He's covered from head to toe with solid gold. He's got a clip shot cut, 3 days old. Still he's covered in head to toe.
That one is kind of in the same tuning as Black Metal Stars. As far as like the rockabilly is concerned, I know if it's rockabilly, it's like how The Fall would play rockabilly, was kind of where we were coming from, basically. Just like that kind of that melodically, it's kind of ugly a little bit. Yeah, and Justin is doing a cool little thing that's kind of super creepy. Pen and paper in my pocket all the time, of where like I just think of something and I write it down, or I come across something and I write it down, and like song titles or something will be like a theme. Little Caesar on the Bicycle is basically just kind of like a Cabbage Town song, because they're these kind of kids, you know, youths in the neighborhood, these that kind of like, you know, I guess they were slanging drugs, I don't know, just kind of, but like, you know, Cabbage Town family kids, you know, descended from people who their families lived in Cabbage Town and probably worked in the mills. My imagination, you know, kind of like city billies, or, you know, Appalachian folks. Cause I mean, like back in the day down the street in Cabbage Town, somebody like grandfather who'd been living with them passed away, and his body is on display in the living room, you know, before going, you know, being interred into the cemetery, like a super old school country way of handling death. You know, it was like, we're going to do it right here in the living room. Back then, they were like, every year there was a Cabbage Town reunion, which was like legit. People came back who used to live there, you know, older folks and stuff. And it was like, it was a scene. It was a thing. Very interesting. That's long gone. But at the time, that was like everyday life. That was my observation, slice of life, what it's like without knowing, just what I see and trying to describe. There are like these kids around wearing, you know, like Adidas sweatpants and a gold chain and no shirt and sneakers and just kind of mischievous, you know, generally raising hell, you know what I mean? And I just thought of this Little Caesar, like this Edward G. Robinson gangster, you know, 30s gangster. You know, there's a movie called Little Caesar with, like, I don't know, maybe James Cagney or Edward G. Robinson. The thing was, like, he was, you know, this kid. I thought all this stuff kind of seems like some little short movie to me. I can just kind of see, like, some 14-year-old, 13-year-old on a BMX bike, you know, if I was to take a picture of me, like, you know, pose, looking super cool, you know, a kid on the street, you know, and it's like, that's his life and it's making it happen.
With its subtle touches of psychedelic background vocals, piano, and keyboard strings, the track Across the Piedmont is both a deceptive and masterful execution of the perfect pop song. Yeah, that's right, I said it. The perfect pop song.
Almost positive. Yeah, that's just like sampled strings or something, like, to really take it over the top with the Maudlin sounds. But yeah, that was some sort of Rob Dow magic, pulled something up. Like, check this out. What do we do this if I hook this into here? And look, now when you press this keyboard, it's each note is a string. And then, Justin, go do something with that. Yeah, this song started from like another guitar tuning thing. Like, we had a song called Cry, Cry Baby from Cry that I had to kind of add some low end to the group. I would tune my guitar, my E down to probably being just like a smart ass. Like, oh, everybody's going to play in D. Well, I'm going to go all the way down to A. The thing, but then I was like, oh, this sounds pretty cool, the two strings in unison, and like you can play the guitar and make a like pretty good bass line at the same time. So I was fooling around with my guitar with the lowest string tuned to C, and then just kind of found this cool drone, and that's just kind of like the ga-dong, 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 where the C is droning while the music goes up. And then goes to like then this relaxing chord after that walk up. And it, to me, it reminded me of like Wichita Lineman or something. I mean, maybe not to anybody else in the world, but to me, it like some sort of like Jimmy Webb, like expansive, yes, cinematic vibe is what I got of it. So, you know, a love song, I guess, or missing somebody or trying to, I don't know, maybe unrequited love, I guess, but without the other person even being aware. But like just trying to like send some psychic energy over a long distance to try and get into somebody's mind, perhaps.
The cinematic small-town soap opera contains an ominous organ-assisted groove that pairs nicely with the track's episodic lyrics. Get up out of bed and pour some water on your fevered head. Get on up out of bed and pour some water on your fevered head. In due time you'll forget. So pull on your downtown party dress. There's cats in your head, but don't listen to a thing they said. There's cats in your head, but don't listen to a single word they said. The sun will shine on you. Oh, oh, will once again shine on you. Oh, da, 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 da. Come along, come along. This won't take long. The stars will shine. The storm clouds have all gone. Come along, come along. This won't take long. We'll show them how we mend a broken heart. Now you're back there again.
That, you know, guitar part is like theme to a TV show. It's like a theme to a soap opera. You know, that kind of spurred my thinking, at least from like a lyrical standpoint, sort of. There's kind of a like a melody going on, but it's not, you know, overt, really, you know. It's another prime example of Brandon's bass, like really, like holding it all together and like kind of being like the main voice a little bit while everything else is just kind of laying a different kind of melodic bass, as it were. Yeah, it's a weird song. The basic picture in my mind is almost like a summer place with Montgomery. Is it, I don't know if it's a summer place with Montgomery Clift and Shelley Winters and Elizabeth Taylor, kind of like a, you know, wrong side of the tracks kind of thing, you know, in my mind, kind of like, you know, I'm thinking of, and it's interesting. I was just like up in the, got family up in Rome, Georgia, you know, kind of small town, but not too small. Got a, like social strata going on there. Kind of the idea of the song is like somebody did something wrong and somebody's gonna make it right, kind of thing. Somebody's brother's gonna go defend somebody's honor, kind of thing. And it might get messy.
Goodbye to the worried days of the step and old song. The track Misty Took a Holiday, complete with gang vocals, tambourine shaking, and expertly placed moments of vamping, is an explosion of sweat-drenched garage rock splendor.
That's another weird song. Yeah, it's got like some weird, like I'm doing some like harmonics on the guitar. Yeah, that one, I don't have a strong recollection of what exactly was going on there. Just other than like a good jam to play. I'm sure there's somebody deep down in there I was thinking about that probably just wanted to put somebody named Misty in a song. I'm sure Misty hung out with the Little Caesar on a bicycle. The Woods of Hemlock Park, with its ambiguous lyrics that at times evokes a sense of romance while also evoking a sense of menace, continues the wild desperation found in the previous tracks, and eventually devolves into a string band breakdown that channels the spirit of Cabbage Town's earliest inhabitants. Something's going on in those woods of Hemlock Park. It's a park by my aunt and uncle's house that probably when I was very, very, very young, we would maybe go to. It's just got a killer name, Hemlock Park. Lots of, like, in my mind, like, weird movie references and references to stuff. But, yeah, it's like something. It's almost like there's some sort of, like, out-of-focus flashback going on. Yeah, there's, like, something has happened and like somebody's being chased through these woods. And yeah, it's kind of intense in its kind of theme. It's, I don't know how to explain it. It's like a vibe, you know. It's hard to explain a vibe. I mean, I tried to put some words to it, you know, but it's not specific, you know. It's like something's happening, but it's not really clear. Certainly, like, the chorus is so, like, normal, you know, just kind of like hope rock or something, you know what I mean? It's just like major chords, really simple melodically. Yeah, sometimes I would be like afraid to do anything that was that straightforward and, I don't know, not challenging or something, you know, I embraced it. By then, I was just like, the release from the weird verses was very satisfying. Old-timey music adjacent at the time, at some point in his life, really got into like old-timey music, bluegrass, fiddle music. He had a pretty good knowledge of old-time music, and he was going, you know, the first country record, fiddling John Carson, is from Cabbage Town, and he made what's considered the first country music record. He could, you know, whip out that fiddle and like scratch out a little tune on it. So we kind of shoehorn a little bit of that City Billy Cabbage Town vibe into the record. I don't know if it works or not, but that was our mixtape little interlude skit.
Inspired in parts by Lopez's friend and former bandmate Benjamin, a prominent figure within the Cabbage Town scene, Freedom Puff is a dynamic indie rock number, enhanced by the band's signature employment of reverb and vibrato, created partly through the use of Lopez's vintage Epiphone Futura amp.
Yeah, I love that amp. I was just talking to somebody the other day about that amp and Gibson amps, and it had this just totally insane reverb tank in it. I think the bed of the recording is Justin and myself. Justin playing the drums and me playing the guitar in like a practice space. We may have, and then took it to the studio and built upon it. I can't remember what we recorded it on. It could be something literally like a cassette recorder, like press play. It might even have been a boombox or something. And then we recorded it onto a track, and then I kind of built it up from there. There might even, now that I think of it, be like Ballard playing to those drums as well. There might be like two drum sets doing that, sort of doing the same thing. Could be wrong, but it could be the case. We'll be right back. It might be about Benjamin from Smoke. He had a band that my friend Jim Pribble, they were in together. Freedom Puff was the name of the band, which I always thought was a killer band name. So I think I'm kind of using the name as a proper name, you know, as that's a person. Distinctly remember, like, knowing what I was doing in the chorus, but didn't know what I was doing in the verse, and was like, got up in the morning and probably had been up super late working on the record. I needed to finish it. It wasn't finished. And kind of like, it's like, I'm exhausted and caustic. And it was like exactly what I was feeling. You know, I was like, oh, this seems kind of honest. Kind of like one of those things where, yeah, just kind of like a deadline or just, which I wouldn't really say it's like a deadline. I've always thought of like that kind of, because I could drive people nutso crazy with like not being done, go to make a record. Because I prefer, number one, it's probably just, you know, procrastination and ADD, but yeah, needing maybe a deadline. But also, once you kind of, it's been my experience, like you get into the process of what you're doing. So you're doing it every day, maybe for a week or whatever, where you're kind of not thinking about anything else, but like making something. So you're just grabbing whatever's out there to grab and slap it on there. And it's not, in my opinion, it's not haphazard or lazy. I think I find that to be part of the process, you know, the creative process. I mean, that's to me, that's being creative, you know. I don't know if other people do it that way, but it's just like, for me, makes that an enjoyable experience of making a record. And if they're not all done and they're not all spread out, it kind of compacts everything together, and it makes things, in my opinion, a little more thematically holding themselves together, because it's a little slice of time.
Broken-hearted abandon of the wreck in front of your house is a mixture of cacophonous guitars, overdriven organ, and galloping drums, driven by Lopez's intense, love-worn vocals, exemplifying his unique and vulnerable approach to singing.
Yeah, it is vulnerable. It is, yeah. I paint myself into a corner. Well, I guess that wouldn't be the right way. I kind of set myself up like, oh, I'm going to make up this music. And then, you know, I'm not like the type of person that's like playing music and singing and stopping and putting the pencil to my tongue and then writing out some words and fitting it all together. You know what I mean? I'm kind of more like, I'm the singer of a band and the band puts music together, and then I got to put my singing to the music and just, you know, try and fit it in there. Yeah, there's some parts of this song that yeah, as far as singing goes, I kind of felt like I got in front of a good sweet spot for a while there. It's just kind of a smart ass kind of take on, not an actual, it's like, I am the wreck in front of your house, like somebody outside, outside of somebody's house yelling and screaming or whatever, is kind of what this song is kind of about, the wreck, the wreckage, things fall apart, things disintegrate, things get mangled. Yeah, that's basically the theme of that song. In my mind, yeah, there's like a car in my mind, there's a car spinning around on its top. I don't know, that's kind of the what was going through my head at that time.
Melding ample amounts of distortion with an orchestral-like drum arrangement, the anthemic Clarissa Just Do It Anyway is yet another example of the band's proficiency in crafting gems of melodic chaos.
Things we kind of try to do, there's probably five other supremely ridiculous things that we tried and didn't do, but timpani's up, a little timpani sample on a Yamaha keyboard you could buy at Eckert's or something, just has a timpani sample on it, or a little drum set or something, just like cheap presets or something. Yeah, that's like the standard rock and roll guitar through a distortion pedal of some sort, through an amp, like on purpose. Yeah, it's got some some fancy chords in it, maybe a little bit, some Beatles chords, as people say, but then distorted. I don't know, you could maybe even hear a little like Oasis or something in there, but yeah, that's totally on purpose, like let's make this a big distorted rock song. Justin, he has a spaghetti situation of wire and pedals going on. I don't even know what was going on over there, but he had a big bag of tricks of things that he was doing, and at least for me, I've never played through a distortion pedal like that. For the most part, probably 99% of the time, if it wasn't broken, that I was playing Gretsch Blackhawk. I want to think that there was like a Monkees model Gretsch that they're like the same thing. So it's kind of like a cut rate. I mean, it was okay guitar. I mean, I still have it, but it's just like completely falling apart in like, I think it's like probably from 1968 maybe or something, but like the binding is all rotted and falling off. And it's, I think the only thing worth anything on it now might be the two pickup in it. Like the strings are a mile off the fretboard, and it's, really, and I would like string it with the heaviest gauge strings, 'cause I was tuning down all the time. It was like brutal to play. People are like, how the world do you play this thing? I always kind of wanted it to feel like an acoustic guitar, that hardness of an acoustic guitar, but I don't think it was designed to have that much tension.
As we near the end of the record, we get the haunting, multi-layered slow burner, All That Deaf Jazz.
All those hillbilly boys racing their hillbilly toys. They make their hillbilly noise. At the quarry's edge, they'll see the first over the ledge.
That's a weird smear of a song. I know, like, thematically, it's just kind of like about youth and weird, like, I guess, dangerous behaviors or risky behavior. The risky behaviors of youth and kind of death obsessed. I don't know if I dare use the word kind of gothy, but no, I don't know. Musically, it's just kind of moody. It's kind of like some weird theme music. You know, I want to say some tack piano, or, you know, number one is probably out of tune, and number two is probably super old. Perhaps that was an attempt at making a tack piano or some project, you know, like literally putting tacks on the pads, but could be wrong. Sometimes, you know, you go to the studio and somebody else had been there yesterday or, you know, the night before and left something there, and you'd be like, oh, look, whoa, what was going on here? Hey, can you call them and ask them if we could use this? You know, and it'd be, yeah, like a xylophone or marimba, or somebody would leave something. Just way more talented when it comes to something like that than me. I might be like, oh, I really, you know, explain something to him in some really confusing and esoteric way and let him filter it through his mind and, you know, see what comes out the other side.
The album's penultimate track is the relentless 60s-inspired sonic gut punch, Tuesday's Just As Bad.
Tuesday.
you know, the theme of the song, like Tuesday is a person. You know, the song Stormy, I think it's Gloomy Monday, Stormy Monday. They call it Stormy Monday, but Tuesday's just as bad. It's kind of where that comes from. But Tuesday is a name. So Tuesday is a person. Tuesday's just as bad. It's just kind of about rumors and hoping that what you hear about somebody is not true. And then, like, musically, it's kind of, you know, I think I was just kind of describing it as, like, we're trying to do kind of a super souped-up girl group song or something, like some sort of, you know, Shadow Morton, Phil Spector kind of thing, but with cars and fast, you know. Yeah, Ballard is going to town on that one. He's on fire.
The album ends with the impassioned Love Is Boss, with its foundational bed of bass and drums, punctuated by spectral-like background vocals and metallic guitar stabs of spring reverb grandeur. The verses simmer, gradually increasing in energy and eventually building up to a joyous and cathartic release of emotion and sound. It's the perfect finale to Golden Time, in that it encapsulates so much of what this album is all about, while also allowing the band one last moment of triumph. I mean, just listen to the conviction and commitment in Lopez's vocals right here. Isn't that good?
Another one that's like, it's the guitar is tuned down, like the low string is tuned down to like C, like in Across the Piedmont. Justin is playing the drum. Yeah, I'm thinking about it now. It's like dun, dun. Yeah, and it's like dun, dun, dun. And it's like a, you know, play on words. Love is boss. Love is cool. Love is boss. A boss runs to jail. Thematically, that's kind of what this is about. Is like, yeah, oppressive love, obsessive / oppressive love. That's kind of one of those we kind of fell together in a weird way. Yeah, sometimes I might like ask people to do things like, hey, can you go ba-ba-da-ba-da? Not like that, but like this, ba, you know, and like drive them nuts. Also, Brandon is a good singer too. He's got a higher timber to his voice, and it's like really a good tool. Sometimes, you know, you got to really talk somebody into like going ba-ba-da-ba-da on something that's going to be heard by many people, you know, not many people, but they come around to it and get into it. So, yeah, that's a weird, spooky song.
For the album art, the band would use the photography of former bandmate Chris Vereen, continuing the established practice which had first begun with the release of their debut album.
Yeah, Lisa Chenault, an Atlanta artist. I don't know if she was roommates with Chris Vereen at the time. I just thought she'd be a great subject for the cover. Yeah, nothing like too thematic about it, really. Just kind of, you know, in retrospect, design-wise, could have been a little better. Trying to make it, you know, look maybe like it's a book. I don't think that came across, but I wanted to have Chris Vereen's photography in there and kind of wanted it somewhat reflect a little bit of the themes, like I was describing earlier, kind of going through it, a little bit of a not sepia tone, but black and white, but maybe a little more blue and black than black and white, and kind of going out a little bit of the kind of that vibe of, you know, like Little Caesar on a bicycle or Misty or all these characters that are kind of the neighborhood a little bit, you know, trying to put that across. That was the thought behind the design anyway. Kind of straddling the line between old-timey and modern.
Merge Records would release Golden Time on March 23rd, 1999. And though it would receive some positive reviews, the album would unfortunately not go on to garner much attention beyond the scene the band had long been a part of.
It, you know, at that time, I mean, there wasn't the internet really, so you weren't really getting like tons of immediate feedback, you know what I mean? And so even at that time, and then just thinking of, you know, it's kind of like kind of a weird end of indie rock, sort of, you know, and at the same time, like garage rock is actually a thing that's happening and it's a scene, but it's not like, you know, in like, what year is this, 99? Yeah, like the next year, the year, you know, 2000, 2001 is when like you're going to have like Strokes and White Stripes and that whole new rock and roll kind of thing happening. So, you know, there was very limited space in the media for stuff, you know what I mean? Yeah, we definitely existed in the margins of indie fame, indie notoriety. We probably went on like some sort of ridiculous summertime 6-week tour, like all over the place in the US, like by ourselves, maybe every once in a while like hooking up with like a bigger band and opening for them, but for the most part, just kind of doing our thing wherever we could.
Following the album's release, bassist Brandon Smith would leave the band, eventually being replaced by musician William Joyner. With Joyner, the band would record their fifth full-length, Sweet Bird of Youth, which Merge would release in the fall of 2000. 2 years later, on New Year's Eve, the band would play a final show at the Echo Lounge in Atlanta before going on an extended hiatus. During their time apart, Lopez would begin performing under the name Tenement Halls, releasing the project's debut full-length, Knitting Needles and Bicycle Bells, in August of 2005. 9 years later, Spurred by an invitation to play Merge's 25th anniversary celebration, the Rocketeens would reunite, playing shows in their home base of Atlanta, as well as other dates along the East Coast. And in 2018, 18 years since their last record, the band would release the excellent Sixth House, adding yet another strong entry into what was already a solid body of work. A body of work that exhibited a fitting progression with each release, while at the same time maintained a truly singular voice. And it is because of this, while reflecting on the band's catalog, and in particular Golden Time, that Lopez is able to remain proud of what he and his bandmates were able to create.
You know, I haven't thought about this particular record. Like, in my mind, you know, some things obviously are more in focus than others, but I thought there's some, you know, cool things were happening. I thought we were continuing to, like, get better at what we were doing. And I don't know, we weren't, like, just doing the same song over and over again. We had more than one or two vibes, which I kind of dug. We'd try anything. If we had an idea, we weren't bound by specific aesthetics. I don't know. You know, some things are more successful than other songs. Like, some of these songs, I'd be like, I don't like that one anymore. But now I like this one. Why do I like, you know, I mean, there's, like, other records in my life where, like, you know, I like these obvious songs. And then after a while, you're like, oh, well, gosh, the obvious songs aren't even the good ones, in my opinion. I'm not saying other people feel the same way, but just, like, I think this record has, like, different vibes going on all over the place, so you could kind of latch on to it, like something that has got a real poppy melody, or that's got a really creepy melody, and I like creepy melodies, and kind of latch on. A lot of gateway drugs on there. All our records are kind of, I guess, if I look back on it, are kind of a little like that. Something to be proud of, you know, in that respect. Things aren't, you know, one note or boring.
Thanks for listening to In Loving Recollection. A very special thanks to Chris Lopez for speaking with me about this very special record. Another special thanks goes out to my man Clay Harper for helping set this all up. You can stream and buy Golden Time and more from the band at therocketeens.bandcamp.com, various streaming platforms, and mergerecords.com. Seek this stuff out. It'll make you a better person. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram or at inlovingrecollection.com. We'll see you next time. We'll get through this.